Okay, this is a follow-up interview with Professor Ort on 6 September 1978 at his office in Leiden. Well, first, let's just cover these points from the previous interview, which was over 6 years ago now. I was interested in the very earliest ideas that you had after the war. Was your plan just to get a general-purpose instrument? Were you thinking only about microwaves, or were you thinking about all wavelengths? Can you just tell me what your idea was at that time?
No, we were certainly thinking only of microwaves. And as you know, I was especially inspired by the results that Grote Reber had obtained in and from those I realized at once that this would be a given ideal means of investigating the galactic system. Of course, Weber had started already something in this line, but it was clear that his beam was much too large for a real investigation of the galactic system.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea was to build an instrument of 25 meters aperture with the half-degree beam or so.
Which right from the very beginning? 25 meters right from the very beginning?
Yes.
I see. And where did that number come from? Why 25 meters? Why not 50 or 10?
That is a question I can't answer. I mean, it was clear that that we needed much better resolution than Reber's instrument gave. And the 25-meter dish would give half a degree resolution,
mm-hmm.
which should be enough to measure the thickness of the galactic layer, even at distances of 10 or 20 kiloparsecs. And that was the general idea.
I see.
It's a 25-meter. But we started off by using much smaller instruments, these Würzburg Riesen that had been an inheritance from the Dutch army.
But let me ask you now, did de Vogt bring those to Kootwijk even before you asked him to do anything?
Yes.
And what was his purpose for doing that?
He was also interested in astronomy in a general way, but mostly in solar astronomy,
mm-hmm.
In connection with the general problem of interference of with the telegraph service.
Right.
So that's also the way he obtained permission from the general directorate of the PTT in Holland to do this kind of thing.
And you just found out that he had these dishes there, I guess. How did that go? Can you tell me that?
Yeah, I really have to think. I suppose that Professor Minnaert from the Utrecht Observatory, who was a famous solar astronomer, had been in contact with Mr. de Vogt, or the other way around. Mr. de Vogt had taken up contact with Professor Minnaert, and it was through him that we got this, contact.
Mm-hmm. Now, go ahead.
Yeah, but Mr. de Vogt was really interested in pursuing general astronomical research, and he was extremely liberal in putting means at our disposal and making these instruments so that we could actually use them for our purpose. So in this way, we are greatly indebted to him for this beginning.
This sort of research obviously was not really necessary for the PTT by any means.
No. Yeah. Of course, Kortrijk was not a very favorable place for these observations because
indeed.
It was full of transmitters. On the other hand, of course, they had a big laboratory, and that more than made up for the disadvantage.
Well, and another point that Lex Mueller has made to me is that he learned how to very carefully shield equipment, and because he had to operate in under adverse conditions,
sure.
he became much more skilled at these things.
In a way, that may have been an advantage.
But, now,
still, we were glad to escape to a quieter place.
Oh, sure.
Later on.
Was the idea to look at both the continuum and the line radiation from the beginning?
Well, as I said, we had vague hopes that this line radiation would be strong enough and that to measure. But certainly these hopes were not sufficiently founded that we would ever have felt responsible to propose to make an expensive instrument just for that. And so the sound foundation for the instrument was the measurement of the continuum radiation, which we knew was there and was sufficiently strong to be measured.
However, of course, you could build a receiver which could do a front end anyway, which could take care of both of these things. And so it was obvious you wanted to try to build.
Yes, I mean, you needed great sensitivity in any case. And,
now, however, the first observations, I believe, were of the hydrogen line. There was no continuum observations carried out before the hydrogen line. Is that correct? Except a test observation on the sun or something like that. But there was no galactic mapping.
No, I believe that is correct.
So at some stage you must have changed and said, well, okay, we'll do the hydrogen line first rather than doing the continuum.
Of course, we were more interested in the hydrogen line than in the continuum because it promised more. But I would have to look up the old records to see exactly what the plans were. Because the receiver that was being built by Mr. Ho was really the first receiver. We have built, and this could be used for both purposes.
Right.
But at the time when this receiver was almost getting into operation, we had apparently decided to concentrate all efforts on the line first.
Right. So somewhere in there must have been a shift, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, let me ask a general question. You've mentioned Mr. Ho, and then, of course, Mueller came along and was much more successful. The general Dutch philosophy of engineers and scientists, it seems to me that there is a more well-defined role for the two categories of people than there are in other countries. Would you agree with that?
I'm not sure that I quite understand your question.
Well, that scientists do not get so involved in building equipment as in other countries.
Oh no, certainly not. And that was partly due to the to our isolation during the war years, by which no radar equipment was being built here, and partly also due to the fact that the only people who were building equipment were people connected with industry and with Philips in particular,
right,
who had no no direct interest in science or in astronomy, and they had their hands full, so to say, with their own industry.
Sure.
Because they were also behind when the war ended.
Right.
And for the same reason, it was very difficult for us to find quite competent people to start this. So in that way, we started at a very low level, so to say, technically.
Yeah. But you are saying then that this is not particularly the way that science is done in Holland. This is something that was more peculiar to radio astronomy. I was wondering if it was a Dutch way of doing things in science.
No, it was... I think the way radio astronomy started was somewhat different in Holland from the way it started in other countries, because in Holland it started very specifically by astronomers who were interested in certain astronomical problems.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. They just wanted to engage engineers
who could
work for them, so to say.
Yeah.
Well, in other countries it started the other way around. I mean, there were technical people who then became interested in the question of whether they could use their techniques for astronomical purposes.
And eventually they engaged astronomers to...
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, a related question is the relationship between the radio astronomers and the optical astronomers. First of all, let's just say here in Holland, was it looked upon as sort of a strange activity that didn't really have much relevance to photometry and traditional astronomy, or was it realized that this could say something too? What sort of attitudes did you run into amongst your optical, more traditional astronomers?
No, I don't remember any conflict of that kind. The conflicts, I would say, arose only at a very much later stage when so much of the money that was available went to radio astronomy and relatively so little to optical astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
But in the early days, most of the astronomers certainly in Leiden and also in Utrecht were very much interested in extending their possibilities by radio astronomical methods. In Utrecht they were interested in the sun mainly and the problems that the sun presented, but it was evident that also there the radio research could open new vistas.
Now, you say at a later stage that there was some conflict. Now, are you talking about the Twinkle dish, or you're talking about later, even in the Westerbork era?
You mean at later time?
Yeah, you said at later times.
Oh, that was only much later, I would say, only during the last 5 or 10 years.
Oh, that much, in the 70s, you're saying, yeah. Okay. Okay.
Because in the early days and in the development, it was clear to everybody that this was such a fertile field that we had already at an early stage a rather prominent position in the world in this line, and that we should pursue that as possible. So there was general agreement on that, I think. There was no fighting among astronomers.
Now, what about on an international scale? I have heard some people who have talked about disparaging remarks that various...
About?
Disparaging remarks, unkind remarks that some prominent optical astronomers made about radio astronomy, saying that it was a waste of time, shouldn't be worried about.
In the United States, you mean?
Well, specifically, yeah, but... But did you run into any of these attitudes amongst your international colleagues?
No, not at all.
Really?
No.
Hmm. Okay. Okay, another general question. How was it that the research directions were determined here in the Leiden Sterrewacht. Was it a matter that you finished one project and you said, now what does this lead to for the next project? Was it a matter that you made the decision which way to go, or were there roundtable discussions about which way to go? Can you just tell me something about how this decision-making process would go on?
You want to know whether I was a dictator?
I'm just curious.
I always had the feeling that these things grew in a natural way, and that was never a moment in which important choices had to be made. Because the progress of the work depended largely on what could be made in the way of receivers, could be made technically, and mm-hmm. our technical staff was limited and was largely guided by Miller during a long time of the Stichting. And, well, he was a very practical man, and so I had sometimes disputes with him that I would like to have things made more quickly, and but that was about all. I mean, so
sure. Well, these things are natural
questions.
Yeah. But you're saying.
As far as the programs were concerned, yeah. It was clear that we had to concentrate mostly on the hydrogen line work, because there was still an unlimited amount of work to be done in that field. But we did make, in the meantime, we did make also continuum observations at several wavelengths.
Right.
But I don't remember that there was ever a serious competition between the two. And mm-hmm. there was enough time for the continuum.
Well, let's take that as an example. For instance, Westerhout's continuum survey of the Milky Way. Was this an idea that a student would come and say, I want to do this, or was this? Did you have a list of these things and students would choose which they were most interested in, or did you say, you know, more or less to do a promotional job to sell it to a student?
Yes, again, I don't think that there was any very definite definite plan. I mean, it was natural that we would do continuum observations, and it was also natural that those should be discussed. And then it's natural that you find students who are willing to do this. And the survey of discrete sources was, of course, a natural outcome of that also.
Are you saying that
I see things relatively easily.
Well, this is what I'm... Are you saying there are no difficult decisions? It just all comes naturally, at least in the way
I feel it, yes.
Yes, okay. Well, I mean, I think this is perhaps why you're able to make so many contributions, is that it all comes naturally to you. Okay, let's...
But maybe if you talk to Professor Blau, he may give a somewhat different view. That was at a slightly later stage when... in the early stages it was principally the Leiden Observatory which was engaged with the galactic research.
Right.
But later on, when Professor Blau returned from America, he also entered the game, and he quite naturally wanted to design his own programs, and so he started to concentrate more on the individual structure of clouds and high latitude observations.
In Groningen,
yes. But again, I don't think there was ever a conflict there, because we were never that short of observing time at that stage that we couldn't do all that we could find time to reduce and to discuss.
Okay, let's move on. Well, another question which may be difficult for you to comment on, but I'll try anyway. It seems that if one looks especially in the era of the 50s, that there were a large number of very good students who came through the Sterovakt here, and many of them went to other countries and are still leading astronomers. Can you shed any light on why there were so many good students? What do you think is the policies that you had that led to this success in training astronomers?
Well, I think there was a difference, for instance, between the Netherlands and perhaps I should say more in general Europe, I mean, might include England, for instance, and the United States, on the other hand, in that at that time, my impression was that in Holland, for instance, the young students we got in astronomy had a stronger vocation for this special subject. Well, my impression in the United States was often that they took it more as a they chose a profession, so to say, and this could be physics in one case, or mathematics, or astronomy. Well,
now by vocation, you mean a real love of the subject when you say a strong vocation?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So love that they had already in the in their school years, reading Flammarion and Jules Verne and so on, and that played a larger role in Holland than in the United States. I don't know whether I'm correct in supposing this, but
that's an interesting comment. Yeah.
But for instance, Martin Schmidt certainly was of that kind, and I think Westerhout also. But for the rest, I think it's largely a matter of accident also, that at some time, some period, you have many good students, and other periods it just happened to be less. Right now, we have a good many very good students here. Groningen used to have, or had very a good many very good students a few years ago, but they're short of students now.
Yeah.
So this fluctuates.
Yeah, sure.
And there's no deeper, perhaps no deeper meaning behind them.
But you don't have any particular things about the way a graduate student is trained here that you think are important to...
No, I don't think they're trained any better, than certainly not better than in many places in the United States.
Okay.
Many places in the United States where they're certainly trained much better than here, in theoretical ways, for instance.
I'm sorry, I should have asked this earlier. Back to De Vogt at Kootwijk. Did he ever carry out solar observations, De Vogt at Kootwijk? After all the trouble of getting these dishes and so forth, did he ever do anything with them?
Well, in a way, yes. They had for a long time a continuous survey of the sun at one or two frequencies. And
Was this just after the war also?
After the war, yes. I don't think that he ever discussed those himself. And that they were always discussed by astronomers at Utrecht, Observatory. But whether they ever had a combined publication about it, I don't know at the moment.
I don't think there is.
You'd have to ask Mr. Fokker in Utrecht. Yeah. He would.
Well, in fact, I'm going to talk to him on Friday, so I'll ask him that.
He would know.
Okay, let's look at a couple of the specific papers which were neglected last time. The first one is the paper you wrote with Westerhout in 1951 on the nature of the galactic background. And you proposed a model where it was due to an unknown type of star which had such and such a density per cubic parsec and so forth. Earlier you called this a sin in that... sin being defined as later on turning out not to be correct, but what I'm interested in is how did you view the subject at that time? Why did you choose to go that way, as opposed to something to do with the interstellar medium?
Well, it was quite evident that these sources were not distributed in a way that resembled the distribution of the interstellar medium, and because there were far too many at high galactic latitudes. But it was not at all clear at that time that one was dealing with a mixture of very different sorts of things. I mean, objects that were actually in the galaxy and extragalactic sources. The idea of the extragalactic sources had hardly arisen at that time,
sure,
as far as I remember.
Right.
And so we tried to find a way of fitting them into the galaxy by hypothesizing about a special type of object that would have this queer distribution, some concentration to the galaxy, on the other hand, very many at high galactic latitudes. But I would have to reread the paper to remember exactly what we thought at the time.
There were no identified extragalactic sources when you wrote this paper.
No.
And of course, the radiation you were trying to explain, we now ascribe to synchrotron radiation. Mm-hmm. From the cosmic rays. So
idea had not arisen at all.
But why was it more acceptable to you to propose a new kind of star rather than a new kind of interstellar medium with a different distribution from the...
Well, I suppose because we were... so much impressed by the fact that everything we knew about the interstellar medium indicated a very thin layer, and there were no phenomena at all that pointed to the possibility that it would rise to greater heights above the plane. And then again, I mean, the discrete sources, of course, didn't make one think of an interstellar medium as the ultimate explanation of these sources.
Mm-hmm. And they, of course, had a more or less isotropic distribution, the ones that were known at that time.
Which was surprising also for stars, of course, but...
Well, this made you have to have... a lot of these things, because they had to be nearby,
yes,
and therefore low luminosity.
But why we did not think of the possibility of extragalactic objects at that time, I don't know. Of course, one is apt to forget at the present time that extragalactic things were something a little bit out of the ordinary at that time. And well, we knew about spiral nebulae and so on, but it was quite clear from these observations already that these objects were not related to bright bright galaxies and so on.
Right.
So, and it's would have been quite a novel thought to think that they would be connected with galaxies that were nearly invisible, like the Cygnus A.
Oh, sure. Oh, I agree.
That was a jump that we couldn't, at that time, have been supposed to make.
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly. Also, of course, the luminosities that were implied, if you put them at large distances, were rather frightening.
Yes. That was a real, very big jump, and that could only be made after the discovery of the Cygnus A source.
Right. Okay, another paper was the AAS Russell lecture, which you gave in December 1951 on the optical and radio galactic structure. And this was before the Kotfike survey had been taken, but clearly you had gone through all of the methodology that you were going to use. Mm-hmm. You had it all in your mind, exactly how you were going to do this. It was just a matter of getting the actual numbers. Is that correct?
Well, again, I would have to glance into the paper to remember exactly what I thought.
Well, if we look, let's see.
We were certainly interested in spiral. The spiral problem of the galaxy was, of course.
So here you're talking about theoretical profiles at different longitudes and so forth.
Yes.
And you talk about the plans to construct the Dwingalow dish, even though the Kotfike dish had still not really begun its survey.
Yes.
But I get the impression that you saw all this happening in the next few years, and like I said, it was just a matter of getting the actual numbers. You could almost write the paper. Just had to fill in the numbers. Is that fair?
Well,
is that fair?
I think that is correct, yes. Because at that time we...
You also talked about the continuum radiation,
yes.
Of course.
Yes, this was mostly on the continuum, which was at that time a sure basis for discussion because it had been discovered already. And... but the 21 centimeter line had been discovered, so at the end I did go into that, and we had already in our first paper observed some line contours
right.
at various longitudes. I don't remember whether the actual rotation curve of the galaxy had been discussed already.
Well, you have a figure here.
Oh yes.
Okay, the dots come from a model.
Right.
Based on stellar observations.
Yes. Yes, at that time, yes. At that time, we had made one observation already at Kotfike, and that agreed with the expectation of the rotation curve. And we had been interested, of course, in the structure and the dynamics of the galaxy for a long time before the advent of radio astronomy, and so we had built models, mass models already.
Sure.
before and during the war, and it was evidently very interesting to us to try to compare those with what one would expect the line profiles to look like.
Do you remember, you probably went to other places in America when you gave this lecture. Did you visit any radio astronomy installations at that time?
I certainly visited Harvard, but...
do you have any reminiscences of that visit?
I would have to look at that, look it up. I don't know. Probably also Cornell, but I don't remember whether that was during this year. Maybe not, but at Harvard they had started some. Although Purcell and Ewan never continued the work, and
right,
but it was taken up rather soon by Bock.
Right, right. I've talked to him, of course.
But I don't remember exactly what year that was. What year they started?
Okay, well, let's move on to the paper on the polarization of the Crab Nebula, which you did work you did with Walraven. You presented this at Jodrell Bank, and then, of course, wrote it up later in BAN in 1956.
That gives some of the history, I think.
Yes, it does. Yeah. It's historian loves to see these sort of things you give here, although it's a bit more chatty than one can afford to have in today's papers, I think. Wouldn't you agree that?